folks, it's Steve Wiest. Look, we're back with another episode of the Leadology Podcast. This is where we talk trombone to trombonists and lots of other stuff. And man, oh man, have we got a fun episode today. Oh man, this is Paul McKee Day. And I'm going to tell you all about that in just a minute. But I was thinking, you know, on the trombone, is there a perfect note? How about a D flat? Yep. That's like a perfectly smoked beef brisket note. The D flat, dog flat. Yeah, Paul McKee. Come on now. One of my all-time favorite jazz trombonists. One of my all-time favorite composers and arrangers. State-of-the-art jazz educator. And most importantly, a really great guy. As Maynard Ferguson used to say, one of my favorite humans. He's a true mensch, folks. And since the 1980s, it has been my great privilege and joy to be his friend. Man, we have gotten into some shenanigans. I think I've laughed harder being around Paul than anybody else I know. He's been with me through my highs and my lows, and he's been a most excellent friend, and I've learned so much from this guy. And now we all get to learn something from him and about him. So without further ado, let's go talk to Paul McKee. Hey, look at this. It's Paul McKee, ladies and gentlemen. Look at that. Wow. Oh, man. It's so good to have you here. And boy, the audience, huh? Could we get some security here? They're a little out of control. I know it's Paul. Yeah. But still, get the audience. Settle down, folks.
I'm impressed you could fit so many people into your house.
It was I had to cut a deal with the Chicago Fire Department, but yeah. All right. We're settling down now. So, good to see you. Looks like we're looking into Boulder Central there. Is this the—
Yes, this is Boulder, actually Broomfield, Colorado.
Oh, that's right. You and Angie live outside of Boulder.
Yeah, we're kind of just pretty much exactly between Denver and Boulder.
Nice.
So good location.
Deborah and I are hoping to get down that way soon. We'll have to grab a coffee. She hasn't been there since she was little, so we got to do some Colorado time.
Yeah.
Okay, gallery. So this, what's that?
I said that's quite the gallery you have behind you there.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, this is, this is Wiest World Central, this Wiest World Publications right here. I have all
this
my...
Where it all happens.
This is where the magic happens, baby. So I got all my Muse tomes, everything, you know, little paraphernalia, Star Trek collection, everything, just so I can look at it and feel like, this is
exciting. Yeah, it's nice to have a hang like that.
Yes. This is the proverbial man cave for all the magic. Speaking of magic, we're gonna go back. You see, now that sounded showbiz, didn't it? This is, I'm gonna say at the beginning, before this even starts, post production, I'm gonna talk about how we've known each other forever. And but let's start with— I was trying to think of this. Did we ever meet? You were on the road starting 83, and I started 81. I was there till 85. Did we ever meet on the road, or was it only when I was in Whitewater?
I started January of 84.
84, okay.
And I swear that we crossed paths with Maynard's band.
I thought we did.
Multiple times, maybe.
And that was, and we'll get back to this here when we go chronologically again, but that
I was just talking about, the first real hanging I think we did was that Whitewater?
I think it was at the camp, yeah. That was the first night, yeah.
This was in the 90s, so we had the camp was in June, just when the NBA finals were hitting.
That's right.
In the height of the Jordan years.
That was rock and roll.
And so we finished the concert and run back to the dorm and watch the game.
Yep, it seems like we did that for a number of years in Emporia, and then we imported that
Emporia, that's
tradition.
what I meant. Yeah, right. We
Yeah,
started Emporia.
right. That must have been where we first met, and then the camp started up in Whitewater, and that
That
became a
was the
hangout.
era of the Guinness soaked
Oh,
brat and the
yes.
Special K bars.
Woo! The aorta bombs, the Special K bar. That was my great insult to all things healthy. You take something moderately healthy like Special K and pour all the whatever it was that was on there, and two different kinds of chocolate chips, and ooh, that
Well,
was good.
at some point, we may have to discuss a little short version of the last hang,
Yes.
last the Whitewater hang.
Taking the camp down swinging in flames. It was a blast.
We went and bought the pig.
Oh man. Okay, we're gonna have to focus on that one. So let's go
Yeah.
chronologically, and I bet we get there.
Okay.
And if we go off the rails, it's totally cool. But
Oh, it's going to happen.
yeah,
You know it's
it's
going to.
already happening. It's what I was hoping. That's what I was hoping. All right.
If we
So,
get to trombone, cool. If not, whatever.
oh, that's right. This is a trombone show. I forgot. Okay, the beginning of Paul McKee. He begins. Is that in Indianola, or is that just where you went to school first? You see, so you were
That was where I
started.
grew up and went to high school and
Yeah.
such. Yeah.
This feels like I'm looking at cards here, like it's the Actors Studio. Paul McKee begins in Indianola. So high school is there. So what are some of the earliest? I was reading a couple of interviews. Your dad was playing jazz records, but early on it didn't really stick. Or what was the early household McKee experience?
Well, I mean there was a lot that he was a jazz fan and he played a lot of stuff. He liked Jimmy Smith and I'm trying to think of what other records we had. But it was just I started listening to it and I didn't really formulate an opinion until later. And I think it probably kind of, I assimilated it and then it came out when I discovered high school jazz band,
Right.
which is
So,
really when I started practicing. I really wasn't a super vigilant trombonist up to that point, but then I discovered, playing in jazz band and improvisation and such. And I said, okay, this works. And then I
nice.
started practicing and started getting better, and the rest is boring history.
But that was an interesting wrinkle here is that I always assume that you had mentorship and a strict tutor helping you every step of the way. You were kind of self-taught in the early days.
Well, and way back in the 70s,
Right.
we didn't have all the technical, technological stuff that we have now, and so there was no YouTube, and so you had to go out and go hear a player when they're nearby, like you hear Maynard's band when they're okay, we can make that drive easily. We're going to go hear Maynard's band,
Right,
or
right.
well, the like. Learning jazz trombone, that was from records.
Right,
That wasn't
totally.
there wasn't any teacher, like discovering JJ and then discovering Fontana and trying to emulate what they do just by listening to records. I remember the first Fontana I heard was on that Super Sax Salt Peanuts.
Oh, yeah, that's a good one.
So you've got the Salt Peanuts rhythm changes solo and confirmation, and I think Yardbird, I believe, were the ones we
I
blew
think,
on.
yeah, I think so.
That was like I bought it because there was a trombone player's picture on the back. This guy Paul
Ah.
Fontana, never heard of, and I said, "This is it, man. This is my guy."
Yep. Golly, that's one of those lightning bolt moments when it hits. It's just like there's no doubt about it. And I think he's been with you ever since. That's kind of a thread that we'll be looking at here in the book of McKee that I'm reading.
I always liked his, if we want to talk trombone actually for a minute here, I always
Sure.
liked his doodle tongue style.
Yeah.
There were no books back then, like Curtis Fox. I think that was one of the first book multiple tonguing kind of books that came out.
I
And
guess so. I didn't even have that one.
yeah, and so I just kind of and I remember once I had some opportunities to see him, then I'd start getting some little. He wasn't the most articulate clinician ever, but he would just say, yeah, here's how I do it. And he picks up his horn and, you know, he does the whole Carl thing. And you go, okay, well, that's semi-helpful.
Right. Yeah. Well, you believe in it because there it is. You can hear it. You see it. When's the first time you saw him live that you got to actually talk with him a little?
That was on Woody's Band. I credit Woody's Band with, besides the experience of itself, but also like getting to cross paths with all these heavies, you know, with Carl and Art Terry and, you know, et cetera, all these people that we got to back up and play with. And so that was definitely a benefit of being on the gig. And so, yeah, Carl, we met Fedchuk and I. This was, again, back in this is the 80s. And so the big Vegas post-gig musician hang at the Union scene was happening. You know, and so all the guys would, after gigs, they'd come there and there was a bar and there was a stage and that's where Carl was. And so John had met him before, but I hadn't. So I, you know, that was like, you know, this is a big moment. And so we went in and Carl was at the bar and super nice guy and invited us up to play, you know.
Wow.
And you're standing next to Carl while Carl is playing Carl. And
right.
What was I thinking?
But
it was like just a high point is getting to meet him and cross paths with him several times. John and I went to visit him shortly before he passed.
Yeah.
Because he was kind of, I don't know if it was Alzheimer's, but he was kind of losing, you know.
That's what I heard. Yeah.
And so we wanted to see him while he still knew who we were and kind of pay our respects to him. So we took a trip out to Vegas.
How was that?
It was great. I mean, his daughter was kind of driving him around he still loved, he was obsessed with playing Keno. He always loved to play Keno.
Oh, really? Wow.
And so wherever we'd go, it'd have to be some place where they had a Keno screen, which is pretty much every place in Vegas.
Yes, right. That'd be one place he'd be all right. Wow. But
anyway, it was a thrill of a lifetime. And you know, with JJ, for me, JJ was playing at the showcase when it was in the Blackstone in Chicago.
Right. They had the big room and the small room in the Blackstone. Yeah.
Right. And so I got to JJ. It was just like after the set, he was walking to the elevator to go back up to his room or something. And I just got to, you know, say like 10 words or something to him. Just like, thank you. Thank you. You know, and that was pretty cool.
He was
Go ahead.
I was just going to say he was such a erudite man, you know, just wonderful to hear speak, you know, is articulate. Yes, very, very classy. You never got to meet who now you're going to
Marcelino.
Oh, yeah, I didn't either.
Yeah, or hear him live either.
Yep. I didn't get to either. That would have been amazing. Well, let's see. We grabbed a lot of stuff here. So right before you go with Woody, and so that you say that was in 84. Okay, 84. Right before that, you were with Bob Washett there at Northern Iowa?
No, I had finished my undergrad and I had started in, it was 81 or 2. I started at grad school at Austin, UT Austin.
Oh, that's where you went. Okay, right.
And Donald Knobb was the trombone teacher there. Are you familiar with him?
I am.
He's an Eastman, you know, an Eastman.
Rick Lawn at that time, or
Rick Lawn was down there, and you know, I chose that school just because I wanted a change of scenery. I wanted to go to a bigger city that might have a little more of a scene, and you know, just wanted to have a change of scenery. You know,
sure.
So
that's a
great
change.
I got an assistantship.
Yes,
so getting an assistantship certainly helps.
And that was in composition, right? The degree was straight up composition or jazz composition?
Yeah. It was jazz composition. They didn't really have a jazz composition degree, but they kind of let me skate through on what I was doing.
Excellent. But,
so I knew, being in Austin, I got to know a bunch of the North Texas guys.
Yeah.
Including Chris Sider, who I know.
Yeah, sure. Chris is a buddy for sure.
And, He was subbing on the second chair on Woody's Band, and they were looking for someone more permanent. And he, out of the blue, gave Fedchuk my name.
Was Chris who did that. I didn't realize that. Yeah. Wow.
So that's the thing. If I had not gone to Austin for grad school, these other things might not have ever happened. Just the being at the right place at the right time stuff, you know.
Right.
I always talk about with my students, I say, you know, luck is when opportunity meets preparation.
Boom.
You heard that one, but that's a good
amen.
One.
You know? It is. That's true. That's a
get the chance to do something and you step in and do it, you know?
Right. With that preparation, you have to be able to bring something when you get that chance. But, I run into students that leave that part out, but, that's fantastic. I did not know that piece of the puzzle. So the section, when you first come on, is it you and Fetchok and Wasson, or who was bass?
Wasson came along later. Oh, it's Randy Hawes.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
Playing bass bone.
That's
and,
right.
I got the, you know, I sent in a cassette tape, which is what
I'm
right. And the guys, and as I learned later, the guys on the bus would, you know, get the giant string of headphones connected to the Walkman and, you know, listen to the tape. And then Fetchok called me and said I was on the band. And that was like,
wow,
definitely a life moment right there, you know.
So the cats kind of chose. That's cool.
Yeah. So, man. You know, I started in January, and remember my first gig was at Peachtree Plaza in Atlanta, where I met the band.
Wow. And you know, how was that first meeting? You shake hands with Woody and you meet the cats. How was that?
Terrifying, I guess.
Yeah.
Because you're there's no rehearsal, you know, as you know, these kind of things. You just kind of sat down at dinner with the trombone book, and John said, "Oh yeah, you know, don't play this, and then skip letter C, and then you know, do all this stuff." And I'm like, you know,
right.
And then really didn't get much feedback from Woody initially. I think I met him, and then he kind of ignores you for a while. And he went through a little period where he didn't know if he liked me or not. And eventually, you know, I won him over, I guess. But
now, is it apocryphal, or is this a legendary story, or did it really happen with the whole Spaghy thing?
Oh, that was I've got several stories about famous band leaders mispronouncing my name, which I really complicated. with Woody, it was he was, you know, so many guys came and went through that band that he didn't remember everybody's name all the time. And I remember that Ron Stout, trumpet player, was playing a solo on a tune right before me, and he, you know, left, and I was following him, and I was coming to the mic, and so when I left, he was still thinking about Ron Stout or something, and he said, that's Paul's McGee. Like, it was kind of a mashup of our names, and like, I don't really care if I get it right or not. You know, you're lucky to be here, sir. So,
wow.
And then way before that, when I went to high school, I went to a couple of Kenton camps in Springfield, Missouri.
Yeah.
And you get to hang with the band. And, you know, that was the beginning of, I remember I went 2 years in a row. The first year I went, I was just kind of blown away by it all, you know, starstruck and everything. But they gave me a list of things to work on, excuse me. Which I did over the next year, and I got into a much higher group. I got into Hank Levy's arranging class and all kinds of cool stuff, and wrote a little short piece for the band, who would read student charts on the last day of the camp on Friday.
Oh, nice.
And so Stan was, you know, my piece came up, and I was standing up there next to Stan Kenton. it went fine. It was called First Attempt, of course, and it was it went fine, and the guys in the band were very polite, and they liked it and stuff, and he said Stan asked my name, and I'm sure I mumbled it nervously, and he said so that was Phil Homecky.
Phil Homecky. Woo, that one.
You
I
can see
heard.
Where that could maybe come from.
Yes.
I've been misidentified by the greatest legends of music. So.
Phil Homecky, I love that one.
Well, but Spaghy was the one that stuck.
It did. That's the one that we all reference. I remember hearing about that on the camp circuit, as it were. Well, this is great, man. We're zipping right through, so I don't have to go up it up it up here with my notes. Well, let's do this. You're on Woody's band, and as we both know, the road, you know, all these creative people in a bus, and you hit for a couple hours. You're lucky if you get a rehearsal here and there. Mostly it's being bored and coming up with creative shenanigans. So a couple of stories to request that are some of my favorites. This is my favorite one, and I'll just give it a title and you can run. It's the it was a dance or something, and it was the bald guy requesting like Glenn Miller or something.
Oh, yeah, there's several dance. You know, the thing with Woody's band is that we do a high profile, we play at the Blue Note New York or Hollywood Bowl or something fancy, and then we'd have a lot of in between on the road playing dances,
Yeah, the old
And the thing with Woody's band is that the dance book was, it's like all those 60s charts with Bill Chase, Sal Nestico, Jake Hanna,
Oh
and Gary
man.
Sarah. And so they were great charts, and we'd usually get to stretch a little more,
Yeah.
in solos just, eating clock and
Yes.
gig. And so the dance gigs were fun. We did not, oh, it's a dance gig, this won't be any fun, but the dance gigs
Yeah.
were some of the most fun gigs we did.
I'll
And
bet.
so yeah, there Woody, in a dance situation, Woody would be accessible to the people on the floor. Usually in a concert, there'd be a space or something, and they'd be in sitting back in the audience, but the dancers were, they'd come right out in front of Woody and say stuff to him. And so there was all sorts of,
Oh, yeah.
like the bald guy, I think that was, he was making requests. This is one thing that was a kind of a pet peeve of Woody's band, of Woody it was himself, was when people would request the greatest hits of other bands.
Right, right,
You
right.
know, so like, like one guy came up and wanted to hear, In the Mood, and Woody said, "When they find the plane, I'll play his music." It's like, wow, that was what a devastating line to deliver,
Yes. Oh my goodness.
Bald guy was, he kept coming around and making requests, and he would, dance around and circle and come back up
Yeah.
and Woody. And
Right
Woody
up on
finally
the
got tired of
stage.
it and took his, Woody always had his mic on pretty loud so he could be king of the moment, always.
Yeah,
And he
right.
just took his mic and just bapped this guy on his bald head. And it just went boom, on the ball.
Was
And
through the
we're trying not to crack
head.
up,
I just always imagine like burr, just the sound
Yeah.
that a mic makes when it hits something. Oh,
That was
that's
a
great.
classic. There were all sorts of, it was fun to watch Woody. Some nights, he'd be tired and exhausted and kind of low energy, and I mean he was always high energy when he came on stage. That's what kind of kept him going as long as he went, was able
Right,
to.
right.
But sometimes he'd be lit and a little bit, and he'd be, have lots of one-liners that he's collected over the years.
Oh, I'll bet. Oh
No
my
way.
gosh. When you
Yeah.
think of the cats he hung with. Sometimes there's misdeeds and things. I was guilty of many of those on Maynard's bands, but
Oh,
one.
now we had those guys on Woody's band too. Now let's hear about some of Steve's.
Oh, I I'll just give you the subject is it had to do with an M80 that I blew up right outside of Maynard's room.
Oh, God.
And the shenanigans ensued after that. But and it was at one of his favorite hotels, and we were asked to never come back. And
Oh,
but
man.
one that I heard about, I don't think it was necessarily you, but it was some of the cats had to do with an Elks Lodge and their ceremony. What was that?
Well, that was, we played a lot of Elks lodges, and they'd have like at 11 p.m. or something, they'd have the hour of the moose or something, where they would
That's a
pay
chart
respect
title.
yeah, absolutely. I do that. I collect chart titles. I put them in my phone because I'll never
That's
remember.
a good one. I'll send it to you. The Hour of the Moose.
Like the latest one I got from my friend Brent Sandy, and it's No Trousers for Max.
And
So,
it probably comes from a just a natural conversation, and somebody says
yeah,
something,
let's
and
talk about
yeah,
his cat,
no
No
trousers.
Trousers for Max. So you have to make sure people don't think, oh, is this Max Roach? This is disrespectful,
Right. The Hour
Let's
of
see,
the Moose.
what was the story? Oh, the moose. So
Yeah.
this didn't happen when I was on the band, but this was a famous story from a previous band that
Oh,
they
okay.
turn out the lights and then they shine a spotlight on the moose, right?
Yeah.
And so when they did this, they shine the, they turn out the lights and they shine the light on the moose, and the moose has a lit cigarette and sunglasses on.
No, not supposed to, right? Some cats put
Not
all that
supposed to,
on.
no. It's
Right.
probably incredibly sacrilegious, And
Of course.
That was, I'm sure they got, I'm sure Woody thought it was hilarious, and I'm sure they got in all sorts of trouble for that one. Another one that was pretty classic, and I will not include names.
Okay.
Was some of the guys, I think this possibly could have been a little alcohol fueled moment.
Sometimes that happened occasionally.
Kids stay in school. but somebody had taken a vending machine.
Uh-oh.
Not a vending machine. It was a pinball machine. That's what it was. A pinball machine. And put it in the deep end of the pool.
Oh, excellent.
And they put a bunch of lawn furniture in the pool. And it was and it was on its side in the bottom of the pool. And so one of these not to be named people was laying in his bed going, I can't leave it like that. So he went down and set up the pinball machine upright. So it was like ready to play, only under 10 feet of water. And, you know,
nice touch.
When you're in your 20s, that stuff is funny. And then you get older and you realize that poor Bill Byrne, who's the manager of the band for years and years, had to, you know, was paying for damage done by these idiots. And, you know,
isn't that something?
But it just, at the time, it just seemed like this will be fun.
Right. And you know, it's a tradition that probably goes way back, because the episode that I was referencing, without, because I wouldn't want to get everybody in trouble, but it was one of those nights where we were just inspired to absolutely destroy the place. And we all had our various ways of doing it. Mine was that M80, and this was right after Lennon had been shot, so any celebrity was a little paranoid, and when it went off outside his room, I didn't know it was his room, and I heard inside, whoa, boom, and he hit the floor. He dove to the floor. So a bunch of things happened. Then on the bus, he gave a speech. It was the only time, maybe one of two times, I ever saw him mad, and I felt so horrible because I had been one of the people that got him mad. And Denny was temporarily sitting up at the front of the bus. He had gone up to do something. So when Maynard starts the speech, he sits down behind Maynard and kind of just cowers. And you know, me and the other guys are in the back. I'm starting to cry, feeling so bad. And he's saying, this, you know, when you're a nomad and you're traveling, you have places that are, you know, your little homes and oases that you look forward to. And this was my favorite one. And we've been asked never to come back because of the children on the band. And I thought, oh, no. So I sit down. And Denny told me later that Maynard turned around after a couple of beats and looked at him and went, amateurs. You guys are amateurs. And then he started telling stories. He says, first of all, you don't screw up your own room. You get somebody. And then he told a story about Connie Condoli and Rossellino absolutely destroying, turned on all the faucets in somebody's room and then duct taped the front door shut and had caulking on all the windows so that when they left and were halfway down the road would be, finally somebody would see this room was now an aquarium and they wouldn't have known who did it. And well, that's a professional.
That, I mean, you know, it's like being on the road and traveling that hard all the time.
Yeah.
You know, that was really the hardest part of being on the road. And so letting off steam, you know, like manifested itself in different ways, but
it did. You know, it did. And I'll say for the record that I don't know if it was those two guys, but it was two guys on the band. but yes, these things would happen along with all the great music.
First off, I was going to ask you, you know, on Woody's band, we usually almost always would stay in a hotel at night. Mm-hmm. Whereas you guys had the bunks on the bus and you did a lot of hit and runs.
Right? We did a lot of hit and runs, but in the early days that I was on, you know, like I was 81 to 85, from 81 till about 83, it was just regular seats. Like a regular bus. So you'd have to find some way to sleep on the floor. A couple of people tried the luggage racks, you know, it's creativity. And then Maynard bought one of the old buses and we tore out the seats and put in plywood and made little two seats worth of a bed and we'd all share it. So Danny and I were spooning for a year on the bus.
Oh.
Yeah, it was. You really get to know folks.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to touch that one. Nope.
I know. That's what I said every night. Actually, was.
Oh,
hey!
Gotta get that. You get that instant rim shot going. Yeah.
Yes, post production is going to be virtuositic on this. Oh my goodness. Hey, here's the thing. So you're on the road, you're doing the Woody thing, and before we get to what happened after that, at what point did you start your legendary spectacular record collection? How did that evolve? Because you've still got a giant collection, don't you?
Yeah, I think there was a point where I got rid of a bunch of records because I just didn't want to move them. I think I was moving, maybe it was when I was moving from Austin to Chicago or something. I got rid of a bunch of them. And then, so, you know, and it was CDs at that point, you know, that was the big thing in the 80s. It was the CD.
Right.
And I still, you know, I when I moved to Colorado, there were a bunch of really good used record stores and things here. And
yes.
I kind of got excited about the vinyl. And I see, for me, the way that students listen to music now is they download everything, and they don't even necessarily download a whole record. They'll listen to like a cut or something.
Right. Yeah.
And they won't necessarily take the trouble to figure out who is every musician on this recording.
No liner notes.
And all that. So I just love having the physical product, especially an LP, you know, a nice big artwork.
Yeah,
liner notes, and I just love going to used record stores and just that kind of that musty library smell. You know?
It's and a whole so thing. I'm
definitely old school in that respect. I like the physical product. You know.
Well, you know, it's a little retro nowadays with hipsters anyway with vinyl. You know, my youngest, my son David, has been collecting now. He's approaching 500 LPs, I think. So.
Wow.
Yeah, very eclectic.
Where his tastes run.
Very eclectic. I mean, unbelievably eclectic. He's got everything from Maynard and Charlie Parker all the way over to Weird Al. You know, it's just, and he's got heavy metal, and he favors the 70s, you know, like Zeppelin and all those guys. So, yeah, the 70s are kind of the cool era nowadays.
Well, there's definitely some stuff that I remember listening to a lot in the 70s in high school that I've found, you know, like there's that Discogs site where you can buy a lot of used vinyl, or you can find it, or they'll reprint it and you'll get it new. But like, I wanted to make sure I had a really nice clean copy of Live at Jimmy's, you know.
Oh, that's such
one of the best ones.
You know, and I heard a legend about that. Who did I hear this from? Because it might have been Maynard himself, but I think if not him, it was somebody who I thought is probably accurate, that they had some kind of technical difficulty and Maynard had to come back in and do all the trumpet parts himself.
Wow.
And
which
would be why one of the reasons it sounds so good. It's a section of Maynard's, you know.
I've got my vinyl t-shirt on here.
Oh, look at that. That's hip. How appropriate for our listeners who can't see anything. He just he stood up. It's a turntable with it looks like a weighted arm on there, the whole bit. Very audiophile.
Is it a turntable or is it the Enterprise?
Well, I've got that part. So my t-shirt says USS, and funny, I wore this to a party in Denver and somebody actually came up to me and said, "Thank you for your service."
Oh.
Awesome. It's got the Enterprise on it. Hey, okay, so that was officially off the rails. I like that.
Well, any the vinyl thing, that's you know, you'll have to ask Angie about that because there's always records coming in being
still
delivered.
So this is still underway. This collection has not stopped. That's great. That's good news.
You know, I kind of upgraded. Well, I have that same turntable that you have, that U-turn audio.
Oh, right. Yeah.
And I think, do you have the blue?
I've got the red one because at that time, it was the Vinyl Hampton red thing. So
right. I've got the blue one. Anyway.
Very, very cool. So let's zip through quickly because the big lightning round's coming up. That's where we're going to go through seven Paul McKee charts and get your impressions. I know, right? So that's the lightning round. So this will be the quick part. Let's go through your teaching. So you leave Woody. What happened that eventually brought you to Boulder?
Well, If you want to start more towards the beginning of the teaching, I feel very fortunate to have had some amazing trombone teachers. Probably the one that had the most influence and I showed the most improvement studying with was a guy named John Hansen at University in Iowa. I didn't really have any trombone instruction in high school, and our band director, bless his heart, was an oboe player. I started getting some good trombone information coming my way in college, and that's where I really felt like I really had the epiphanies where you start to really find some success, you know, and desire. And the whole thing was I say this to my high school self who was ready to quit after junior high, that when you start practicing, you start getting better, it becomes fun, you know? And it's not this struggle of, you know. So, you know, then Don Knob, who I said was an Eastman graduate at University of Austin, UT Austin, he was very supportive and big help. And then, of course, you know, all the people that you were in college with, you know, you have all these different players, and not just trombone players, jazz players, you know, everything that you get, you know, that you hang with and learn from. So, you know, I feel very fortunate to have had the education that I had. I also took advantage of it, which is sometimes I get a little frustrated with my students, not my students, but students in general.
Amen. That's it. Yep.
About, like, you've got to go after this stuff. You can't wait for it to come to you. You've got to, you know, you've got to, if you want to truly want to do this, you've got to work for it. It's not, it's different than, you know, than it was in high school. It's definitely more of a commitment.
I think that's what's the word? That's an echo of the fact that we had, were fortunate enough to have to, like you say, you were going to go hear somebody, you had to drive out and see them. You had to go to a store and buy the record, all this stuff. So we had that initiative kind of baked in by the time we get to school.
Cop a lesson, you know, when they're
right,
on their dinner hour, which is very generous of them sometimes, you know.
Yeah, so by the time we get to school, we're used to going after stuff where it could be that, you know, some of the modern great students, and there are some wonderful ones out there, you know, everything's so accessible that the that part can get left out sometimes. That's why they need teachers nowadays as much as possible.
So yeah, that was the early years. And then where were we going with this?
This is now your teaching career. Now you teach, so you leave Woody and eventually you teach DePaul in Florida and et cetera.
Right, yeah, I kind of bounced around and it was just through various circumstances. I moved back to after being on the road, I hadn't really done any traveling of any, you know, amount. When I joined Woody's band, of course, with Woody's band, got to see the world, you know,
right,
to see New York for the first time and go to Europe and hang with all these great guests that the band had. And so I kind of got it. And I had a lot of friends in Chicago, and I did kind of decide that would be my goal after getting off the road, is moving to Chicago. And anyway, I kind of, you know, saved up some money so I could afford to move. And I feel bad for these students that move to New York and they're broke when they show up and they have to take a terrible job and they don't get to do the music stuff that they went there to do. So I always say, you know, save up some money so you can go to the Vanguard or whatever and hear music and cop a couple lessons and, you know.
Right.
I think I segued once again. Teaching. Yeah. So I, from Woody's band, I went to DePaul and I just adjuncted there for a few years. And then I went to, got an offer to go teach out at DeKalb at Northern Illinois.
Oh, yeah. Mark
Carter, rest in peace.
Yes, indeed. And, great man.
Did that for a couple of years. And then I ended up moving out to Ohio. And
that's right.
In Northwest Ohio. So I was adjuncting at Youngstown. At University of Akron, and I liked Northeast Ohio. It's a nice little, you know, Cleveland, and you're close to Pittsburgh, and I got to do a lot of cool gigs while I was there.
Right.
And then from there, I went to UMKC, moved to Kansas City, and I adjuncted there. A lot of this was tied into a marriage that I had taken on at that time.
Right.
And so went to Kansas City, and then the marriage unfortunately came to an end. And so I was looking for full time, you know, and so I ended up getting the job at Florida State, which I was kind of surprised about. It was a really it's a great school, great college of music at Florida State, great gig. Just Tallahassee did not have anything happening for me. And I had to get on a plane to go play, you know.
Right, right.
So I said, this is probably not, and I do not do well in the extreme humidity either.
Same here.
So I knew that the Colorado job, my position was a new position when they hired me. I was waiting for it to be approved and open, you know, be open for a search. And I ended up staying at Florida State for 7 years and getting tenure there, which actually helped me when I did go to Colorado and getting a shorter tenure track, you know. And so, but I feel like out here, to me, like, this is home to me.
You know, that's great. Yeah,
I like the weather. I have so many friends out here, and
such a great scene. I mean, the school, what a great faculty. And I remember you and I moved out there the same year, or very close to it. But man, the scene of Boulder is so hip.
I mean, it's you know, there's a lot of Denver's got a pretty good scene, a lot of places to play. It's expensive out here. I feel bad again for musicians that are just starting out and trying to freelance and having to pay really high rents, but it's, you know, I love the mountains, and I love the weather, and it just definitely feels like a very good last stop for me, you know. No more moving around.
Right. I think you've definitely found home. And another thing we share in common is we looked around a little bit and ended up finding the perfect wives for, you know, and Angie is just the angel of all time. And I'm so glad that you have this home, man. That's exciting for everybody. Are you ready for the lightning round?
Okay, let's do it.
You know what? Let's top off this little bit of history, though, with the Paul McKee Jazz Festival. Tell me about that. Then we'll do the lightning round. Is that the high school that you went to, or what is it?
Yeah, it's Indian Hill High School.
Wow.
Their festival situation had changed around a little bit, so they kind of rebranded it, and for some reason they decided to call it the Paul McKee Jazz Festival, that just like blew me away. It was like, man, you know, it's one of those things where you feel like there's people more deserving of this than me.
Humble, but I think they chose well. I mean, they're looking at one of their favorite sons too, you know, so.
It's a huge honor. And I went, I went back for the first one, which was in February, middle of February. And I did some, you know, adjudicating. I just wanted to be there for the first one.
Sure.
And so I'm going to try to make it as often as I can. If I can make it every year, I will, you know.
That was a lot of us were very happy to see those pictures, because you were back in the saddle, had the adjudicator's outfit on, and there you go. That was happening.
I guess that brings us around to, you know, coming back from what?
Well, then there's that. Yes, you've had a challenge.
A little over a year ago, I was diagnosed with colon cancer. And I have been dealing with that, getting chemo and stuff. And, you know, that's about one of the biggest life changes you can even imagine happening to you.
Right.
And, but I, you know, I'm feeling pretty good. I had some surgery that was involved with that, and I had to lay off the horn for like 6 months, which was brutal. I mean, I've never laid off that long.
And now you're in the process of coming back, which
rebuilding the chops, getting the Remington book out, and, playing lots of long tones, and it's coming back. I'm still working on my flexibility and range and stuff, but you know, I think I'll be fine. And you know, writing music and doing stuff like that, it's kind of been nice to get back. But I don't want to dwell on that too much. But yeah, it felt great to go get out of town and get on a plane and go do this thing. You know, so.
Your ears were probably burning on the whole trip. That was everybody cheering to see you out there again. So that was very cool.
Yeah, it was a nice event, certainly.
All right. Well, it sounds like there's a storm outside. I think that's the lightning round. Post-production, we'll put in some.
I'm looking forward to it.
Some Strike Force 5 lightning bolts going on. All right, so here's what I'm going to do. I've got, it's like seven steps to Spaghetti, I'm calling it.
Okay.
And so I've got seven tracks, and we'll discuss, we'll have our people discuss afterwards as to how much of the tracks I can play, or a couple of them will play the whole thing, or okay. excerpts, but that'll be post-production. And I'm just going to mention them, give you some of my impressions, which would just be like, "Woo, I really like this," and mm-hmm. then... go just tell us you know, what the heck were you thinking on this one, or a recording session might come to mind, or all mm-hmm. kinds of things. Okay, here we are, post-production, and you're listening to what I believe for me and for a lot of people is one of the best arrangements ever done for modern big band. This is Paul's beautiful treatment of, appropriately enough, Beautiful Love, performed here by the U.S. Army Blues, featuring marvelous saxophonist Christian Ertl. There is not a definitive recording of this featuring Paul yet, but there are some fun things, projects in the works, where that will be taken care of soon. What a great chart, man. Oof. So I wanted to play a little bit of it because in the lightning round, we didn't get to it. How about that sound effect for the lightning round? Yeah. I hope you're not tired of it because I'm going to play the hell out of that thing. Anyway, this is a commercial from our one and only sponsor. That would be me. This is a little moment for the book, Leadology. That you can order by going to leadtrombone.com, LeadTrombone.com. And if you go there now, until May 7th, 2024, it will be 23% off the sale price. What? How is that even possible? You're not going to make any money, said all the people to me. But yeah, 23% off because I've done it for 23 days. The book was released in 2023. On page 23 of the book is when we first start talking about the upper register. And my lovely wife Deborah's birthday is April 23. Coincidence? I think not. So there you go. Stop on by Lead Trombone today up until May 7, 23% off. All right then, back to the lightning round, already in progress. Let's start with, I'm on the wrong page. Let's start with the two. Okay, so one of my favorite albums happens to be your album, Gallery, that came out a while back. We all won
95.
Yes, we want Gallery 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, and 7. The world is demanding it. Yep. But in the meantime, we've got that one. And the two tracks I want to, well, I'm going to mention three, but let's start with the two that were with your hero we spoke of. So we've got We'll Be Together Again and Alone Together. Mm-hmm. Let's start with We'll Be Together Again, where you went after Carl in the trading of the solos.
Once again, what was I thinking?
a brave move. Man, you sounded great. Carl sounded great. What was that like? You're in the studio with Carl. Well, you want to know what that was like? This is post-production time. And let's give a listen from the classic album, Gallery. Paul McKee, here's his arrangement with the great Carl Fontana of We'll Be Together Again.
Thank you.
you know, I kind of had that project. It was my first, you know, solo recording. And so I kind of had different things I wanted to do. I wanted to have some, you know, some quartet things where I'm the only horn, and then some things where there's two or three or four horns. And it turns out, just by being lucky, that I was able to, Carl was in town. I think he was out at Beaches.
Oh, okay.
Out at Elmhurst.
Uh-huh.
And I managed, and I already had established a relationship through the meetings, you know, from being in Woody's band. And he, I asked him if he'd come and play on a couple cuts. And he said yes. And so I'm going, okay, be careful what you wish for, son.
Right.
So we did that. And there's a third one that we did that didn't get put on there.
Oh.
It was a blues with a bridge that I called Bloodle.
Bloodle.
And Betchock and I have played that one on two
trombones. Oh, nice.
Anyway, so he agreed to do that. And so we played, and, you know, I also had Bobby Shue was also in town.
Right.
At another point, and I had him play on a couple things. Oh, you know, it was nice to get a couple heavies, big names.
Tim Reese was around. And
Tim played on some stuff. Ron Stout.
Yeah.
Played on some stuff. A lot of, you know, and then, of course, Chicago is so full of great musicians that
always
a lot of the local guys, too. The local instead of the professionals.
Right. You got some good, you got some, you know, Joel Spencer and Kohut, and everybody was, man. Right. So, I mean, I love the arrangement, the chart. It's, oh, you know what? Another thing I noticed when I was listening to it recently, it has one of those classic moments at the end of the fade. Always at the end of the fade is the heavy stuff, and you got to turn it up really high.
Uh-huh. Right. And then you forget to turn your stereo back down.
Right. Bam. But there is, for the listeners out there, crank it up at the end, and they start getting into it there right at the end.
There's a couple times where, like, you know, because I'm listening so much, so hard to him, that we'll just play the same thing, like when we were playing together, you know.
I really noticed that on Alone Together. You guys were like an old married couple finishing each other's sentences. He'd be like, boop-a-doo-da-dip, and you go, bap-a-dee-but, and he'd do the same back to you. Like, he would finish your line.
Well, he likes to do that kind of stuff, and he'll talk about, like the plan was, you know, we're going to play together on the head, but you're going to take different turns being, he called it the lead, right? So he'd be the guy playing the melody, and the other guy would be noodling around you, you know?
Right.
And his noodling was so hip that I almost forgot melody.
It was really, that really sounded like it was fun on Alone Together, because it was just you two guys in bass or something, right? It was.
We started out in the rhythm section, gradually entered. And
yeah.
And,
post-production time. I want to hear it. I want to hear it. I'll bet you do too. Here is, once again, Paul and Carl. This is Paul's arrangement of Alone Together.
Thank you.
you know, it was just one of those things that you're almost like, it's surreal.
Yeah.
You know, I'm actually doing this. I'm standing next to Carl Fontana in the studio, you know.
And that's so now that was, part of his recorded body of work, you know, and
yeah.
And a really nice one too. I mean, you know, that's, he sounded great, you sounded great. And the fun thing that I noticed, you know, is, you know, everybody, including myself, describes you as an heir apparent or a devotee, at the very least, of Carl. But it's when you put the two of you together, it's like, oh yeah, that's Paul. There's enough of a difference, and there's enough of a harmonic vocabulary that's different, that even though, I mean, you sound like you're twins, but it's still definitely Paul McKee there. That's,
well, it's like Carl's was like a musical black hole that you're standing up and playing, and it was impossible not just to get sucked into doing everything he's doing. So I probably played more like Carl on that record than I did it ever again. But
right.
But it
that
was
makes sense.
It
makes sense.
It was a thrill of a lifetime. I mean, I credit the getting on Woody's band as opening up all these doors for me, and being able to, you know, meet people, and I've got this wonderful, you know, supportive circle of friends now, and it's really a nice, you know, it's a blessing. Truly, you know,
it's a family thing that sticks with you your whole career, isn't it? It's I noticed.
And you've been
at, well,
you've been around for most of that, if not just about all of it.
Yeah,
together,
we have been, man. The stuff that we've done and gotten into trouble and done things. Oh my gosh! And you've been there through my highs and my lows and lots of lows, and a very good friend throughout all of it. And that's a community that's just precious. It's so cool.
So one quick story in case we don't get to it.
All right.
The final Weast barbecue.
Oh yeah. Let's do it. Let's do it. So I'll give a little prelude to it, and then
I know we're doing the lightning round, but I don't want to make it included.
I'm already looking at the time and saying, you know, we won't do seven. We'll just do like one or two more. But so it's incredibly fast lightning, because we got to get to this story. So here's the deal.
Let's do the lightning first, and then we'll finish up with the pig story.
Okay.
Something lightning, for them to look forward to.
Lightning and then the pig. Stay tuned, folks. The pig is coming. All right. Let me just pick a couple of them here then. I wanted to mention the Jeff Benedict project, the Holmes, because you've got, it's a nice recording of a couple of your charts. And this gets into a whole thing that could be a whole nother show. It's just your writing and arranging, and which I also love very much. Let's start with Bitter Jug, which is one of the great, great titles of all times. What's up with that one? I sure enjoyed it.
Well, I've always liked, I was looking to write some kind of a contrafact, and I've always liked the Bitter Jug, or Jitterbug.
Right.
Changes. Of course, that tune is usually in three and such. And so I took the changes and I wrote my own melody over it, made it kind of a fast swing tune.
Mm-hmm.
And it also, it sounded like something that maybe like Sonny Stitt and Gene Ammons or someone like that might have played. So that's why I said the Bitter Jug. I don't know how bitter, what the bitter part, but it just worked out with the.
It does. And everybody knows all the cats, you know, every time that chart is passed out, you hear all the chuckling going on. That's so clever.
Clever indeed. You know, we here at the post-editing world agree. Very, very clever title. And this editing team, crack editing team, it might be said, me, myself, and I, not to be confused with the editing team, the former editing team that was on crack. So that was, they had to go. Anyway, so this piece that we're going to listen to now, we are in Christopher Nolan territory as far as length of this program. So we're just going to excerpt it. But as mentioned, this team is good. So we're going to give you some good parts of it right here. Paul's beautiful arrangement, contrafact on Jitterbug Waltz. Here's Bitter Jug.
Thank you.
I love writing stuff like that, like fast swing, sax solis, shout chorus. It's very much a traditional kind of big band arrangement.
Right.
But I just love, right? Like I love writing sax solis and things like that. It's so much fun. I'm just going to continue to dwell in the ancient years, you know?
That's all right. That's all right. I mean, it's obvious, you know, another comment that we all make whenever we play one of your charts is that it sounds great. It sounds difficult, but it's so swinging. It's one of those things that kind of plays itself because it's written so well. I mean, they're not easy to play. There's some fun, tricky things, but it's just so well written. So listeners, kids out there that are writing charts, something to remember.
I think one of the big lessons I learned that I try to pass on to my students is give everyone melodic content. And that's what I learned from like playing Nestico charts. You play the third trombone part on a Nestico chart and it's just as melodic as the lead part, you know?
Right.
And because a lot of the way that he would choose, you know, all the assigning the notes and the passing chords and all that kind of stuff in such a way that you don't have some, you know, weird angular inner part. So I think, you know, if you give everybody parts that make melodic sense to them, they will, first they'll learn the chart faster because it'll lay them. And also they will enjoy it, you know, because it's accessible and not too crazy.
Well, mission accomplished there, man. All right, we'll go two more. Project that we did together, you and I, with the Colorado Jazz Repertory Orchestra with Art Boughton, the Overjoyed, the Stevie Wonder album, your chart on Higher Ground. Great recording. You should have blown on it. It should have been your solo, but of course, Eric Gunnison,
man. He was
and,
the guy.
And Mike Abbott, too, but Eric is like, holy moly.
Indeed, Eric Gunnison, one of the great piano players of all times, and he played with us on this project. Here's an excerpt. We'll take it up to Eric's solo of Paul McKee's treatment of the Stevie Wonder classic, Higher Ground.
And I love it. Here's a little personal comment. I love your floating fourth shout chorus on this, or the prelude to the shout. That's, and the what's the triplet rhythm? That's what's so hip on the on the
just
shuffle.
Subdivided triplets. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I like messing around with that too. Yeah.
So it's higher ground and your approach to it then.
Well, and it's first thing is, well, it's a Stevie Wonder tune. Don't wreck it. Don't ruin it. You know, yep. just try to interpret it and you know, make it have, because that was from Inner Visions, right?
I think so.
Which is like my favorite Steve. I grew up with that record in the 70s mm-hmm. With, you know, all the stuff on there. And was Living in the City on that one?
That one, and then the ballad that I did, I think, is on there too, and which I can remember the title. Yeah, they're very pretty. You and I, I think, is on there too. Mm-hmm. Great.
And what he's a Mr. Know-It-All. Anyway, so
yeah.
It was a fun project. It was hard to pick something because there's so many good ones.
Right.
But that was a lot of fun doing that. And yeah, you had two charts on there, right?
So I had. Overjoyed, You and I, and Living for the City. Hey, it's post-production again. Right here, I cut out a big section that is going to be the basis of another episode with Paul, where he talks about a brand new commission, an arrangement that he was commissioned to write for University of Colorado there in Boulder, on the famous Elgar piece for graduation, Pomp and Circumstance. And he did some amazing things with it. And we will have, within a matter of a couple of weeks, a recording of it. So I'll feature both of those in the next episode of Paul McKee. But let's finish this one up. Clocking in at over 2 hours. Look at us. We now return to some pig, a story about some piggies.
But you know, I hear a sound in the background, and it sounds very, very porky-ish, a pig story to be told. So I will, I'll give a little prelude, and then I can let you do your version of it.
Well, I think you should start at the beginning of the Weiss camps when we were just doing like hot dogs and burgers.
Man, it came a long way. It started, so we were all... Paul and I were in a lot of camps that we were talking about, and that was we were on the camp circuit, as they say. And so when I went to the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, started teaching there, I started a camp. And every year it was Paul. I made sure that Paul would be there and a bunch of our friends, and it became a wonderful hang. And one of the things that we did early on, I don't know if it was official, but we started making it official where Wednesday would be the students would get to do a concert on their own with the counselors, and the faculty would split out to my place or some other places, and we'd have a barbecue and a hang with the faculty. And it started out kind of, you know, low key, like you say, with some hamburgers and some Guinness drenched brats, being up in Wisconsin. And it went from there. Paul, what do you got? We started getting into the smoker.
There was, and definitely the brats was a step up, because it was just like, I think the first one was like at a public park on those little barbecue grills that they
had. It was, yes.
Hot dogs and burgers, you know.
Right.
Yeah. And then, you know, we started having it at your place, and you started making the Guinness soaked brats and special K bars and stuff like that.
Those are so good.
And I think there was, you know, each year it kind of, the bar kept rising as far as the cuisine. Yep. And I know there was one year that I wasn't there that you guys did a whole salmon thing.
That's right. That was Tim Ishii versus Randy Hamm. I think there was a grill off for the salmon, who had the best salmon recipe. So that, yeah, we got off track there for one year, but.
Well, and I'm trying to think of, I think, you know, we can jump right to the last year of the camp. And over the years, the amount of teaching versus the amount of barbecue prep on weekdays I did greatly inverted. And
yes.
So by the end, I really wasn't even teaching on Wednesday. We were out buying meat.
Yes, we went.
Starting the grills.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
We, We had kind of fantasized about doing a whole pig.
Yep. And there was a butcher being Wisconsin right outside of town.
And originally we were going to bury it, cook it underground.
Right.
And then you thought with young children around, perhaps that's not the best option. You and I went to pick up the pig.
Yep.
And they had it, they cut it into chunks for us, right?
Yes.
But they cut the head off of it and they said, would you like to, you know, take this, would you like the head? Traumatize the children for life.
Right. Look at this, kids.
Right. Right. So, but then we had we had a couple smokers and we had a barbecue grills. We had an oven and we had this massive amount of pork.
It was, cook. And we didn't know what the cuts were. We, they were just slabs of pork.
Yeah. I mean, and so we kind of rotated them around through the different cooking methods. So everything got a little smoke and I remember I brought a case of Gates sauce down in Kansas City.
And Mike Williams had his own screaming hot sauce for those that wanted that. So we had the Gates and then the Screamer hot sauce.
But it would have been smart to start cooking those about sunrise.
Right.
Because by the time they were getting tender enough to eat, or it's just safe enough to eat.
Right.
I
remember falling asleep out there. I was watching some of the final stages and it was overnight. We were just finally cooked up the next day. We must have started Tuesday afternoon or something, and it went all the way to Wednesday. I think so. Yeah, I remember waking up and I had the chimneys for the charcoal for the grill. I had set it up and I sat down to wait for it, and I woke up and it was just a wall of flame going. It had already burned out of the charcoal after I fell asleep.
But and then we had pulled pork sandwiches with like coleslaw on top and all that. And I don't know how much, I mean, we fed everybody until they were stuffed and there was still a lot left. And I would like to, whatever happened to the remainder, did it ever get eaten or did it eventually just get tossed?
It got eaten and it in very creative ways. There was pulled pork omelets, the sandwiches for lunch, for dinner, side dishes. Yeah, that I was eating that. As they say in the South, I was eating on that for a couple of months. Mm. It was great. Ooh.
That was a good way to go out, though, I'd say.
It was. There was a number of things that took place that week that was just the best possible way. Well, and we ended up with a record. We recorded at the end of the week. It was an epic camp experience.
Well, and thinking about that and... what was the Kansas camp again? I can't ever remember.
Emporia.
Emporia.
Yeah.
Just memories of those. We could get into a whole nother segment about it, but having Frank Mantooth around for Whitewater and Emporia was just the best. He was just the best cat to do a jazz camp with.
Oh, always.
So funny and just fun to hang with.
Yeah. Always a learning experience too. And of course, as we know, and some of our listeners might not know, he had, very much like Lester Young, he had his own language that we still use to this day, where I find myself, you know, spouting a toothism now and then. And I remember one time just stopping him and saying, tooth, I don't know what that means. Could you? Occasionally, you'd have to just say, oh, you got to define that one for me. But he was the best.
Like, let's see, Short was a car.
Oh, that's right.
Car was a cigarette.
Yep.
Jar store was the liquor store.
Yep. Going to the jar store was libe. It was a verb.
Yeah. Right. and then he had nicknames for.
Oh yeah. Let's share both our nicknames. What was?
I never got one.
You didn't. Oh man. McKee must have just been hip enough.
I guess we had to wait for Woody.
What's that?
Oh, that already happened. No, anyway.
But. Mine was Scroin. Remember how that was quite a morph. It went from
was it Dr. Von Screen?
Yep.
Because you screened calls, apparently.
Yes. Yeah, I was a call screener back in the day when it was obvious you were getting screened.
Right.
And then I think Glenn Koster had brought up the fact that that Wiest is often mispronounced as Weist and misspelled, so I became simply Scrine at one point.
Right. Glenn was Louis Pasteur, right?
Oh, that's Pasteur. Right. Louis Pasteur. Yeah. And Tooth was there through a lot of things, through all the pink slips, as he would say.
Yeah.
He was something, man.
The things about those camps is they were just great hangs with a bunch of people who loved hanging out with each other, you know.
Yeah. It was an extension of the Road family vibe.
Yeah.
It was of course the ultimate camp would be that we just get together and hang. That's the that would be the ultimate camp. And you know, I still hear from students, you know, that it'll be like they'll have gray hair and I'll go play a gig someplace and they'll say, "I was at your camp." And it changed my life. I thought, really? You had a good time? Because we sure did.
My grandson really likes jazz now.
Holy moly. Well, you know what? I really hate to do this, but we've gone over. We're getting close to the 2-hour mark here. And we could go another 4 or 5 days, but looks like we got to stop.
After you go through some of the other stars, we can have a part two.
Yes, definitely a part two. Let's do it. As they say on Podcast World, we'll have you back.
Yeah.
And there'll be another episode.
You got lots more stories.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And talk about post-production. The editing on those would be, take out. We have to bleep half of them. All the names get changed. Well, okay. Man, oh man, this has been fun. You know that I love you and everybody loves you. And this is going to be fun for a lot of folks. Sure was for me.
We're both busy with our lives and it's nice to get together and hang like this. And
yeah.
I'm very grateful for all my friends and thank you. I love you too, buddy, for doing this.
Well, truly my pleasure. I've been looking forward to it for a while. This will be the theme song is going to come in here and more applause from the audience. And we'll have you back for the next episode.
Sounds great.
Well, there you go, folks. Paul McKee. Man, what a great time. I hope y'all had 1/10 as good a time as I did, because I had a blast. And as mentioned, we will have the Paul McKee bonus round where we discuss Pomp and Circumstance. That'll be coming up in a couple of weeks when that gets released. And we'll have great fun with that, followed by our next guest artist. So you're listening to our theme song, the extended version there in the background. That's from my album called Front Range, jazz fusion stuff. But it sounds to me like, you know, there's something coming up right now that we're going to have to stop for in a minute because, you know, every time there's a trombone solo, an angel gets its wings. Get it, Stevie!
Production of Wiest World Productions 2024.